Our next case is Catherine Kenneth against the United States, number 02-2184. Ms. Bauman.
It is the court, counsel. Your Honors, I'd first like to talk briefly about the standard of review. There's some question about what standard is appropriate. For most of the questions that I've raised, we're talking about legal issues. So the reasonable suspicion question is reviewed de novo. The court's incorrect application of Illinois law for the willful and wanton standard is reviewed de novo. The question of whether Kenneth could consent despite an unlawful seizure after the strip and the visual cavity searches is de novo. The clear error standard is only applicable, according to the cases cited by respondents, where there is historical fact at issue. In this case, there was no reasonable suspicion for Martinez, the inspecting officer, to conduct a strip and visual body cavity search of Kenneth. Reasonable suspicion must be objective and must be particularized.
How about the dog?
The dog alert, if that's, let me just say, there was no dog alert. If you read the record carefully, you will see that the dog took interest in a box that Kenneth was carrying. And this is what Officer or Inspector Yates testified to.
But that's the finding of fact that the district court made. She says specifically in her opinion, Shadow alerted, quote unquote, to plaintiffs. So your face, that's just an historical fact. That would have to be clear error review, and it's hard to see if it's how we could say that.
If you review the record carefully and you review Yates' testimony carefully, he stated that there was no alert. And there was a request to admit, propounded and admitted by the United States, which said that the dog took interest in the box Kenneth was carrying. So I think it would be disingenuous upon review of the records, and I agree that that would be a clear standard type
That's
review.
The only way we could, I'm looking at page 4 of her opinion, she describes what you're talking about, the dog working the air, looking at the box and all those things. But certainly the dog, if you want to use it that way, takes interest, and that's what they bring those dogs in for. It's why some people get searched further and others don't.
What Yates testified to was an alert would be, this was a passive canine, so the alert would be perfected if the dog sat down. And maybe we're talking about semantics. He took interest in the box. Okay, if you think that taking interest in a box that someone is carrying is sufficient to move on to the next level, that's possible.
This next level, is there anything in the case law of the Supreme Court that requires a graduated response on the part of the customs agent, or do we have your normal passengers and those upon which there is a reasonable suspicion that indeed there's a problem? Do we have just two categories, or do we have to go through this graduated response?
I don't believe that the Supreme Court has yet made a statement on that. The Montoya v. Hernandez decision talks about the detention of a passenger and the circumstances in that particular case. They specifically said that they were not reaching the issue of various levels of search. Now, the courts have said that reasonable suspicion is required for both a strip search and an x-ray search, let's say. However, as this court has recognized, there has to be some weighing, some balancing, and I think that weighing and balancing comes when you look at the particularized and objective standard. That is where this court and the district court below has should have and has to pay attention. We can't just rubber stamp what customs agents do. If it is a lower standard at the border, and I agree it is, at least we have to require that there are particularized objective reasons as to this person, why this person is being suspected of internal smuggling. And I
we have had quite a few of these cases, and I must tell you that this one struck me as more probable cause, if you will, of internal smuggling. The money, paying cash for the ticket, the sort of inconsistent statements about where you were staying at a resort, only having $6 when you returned. It just seemed to me, if looking at this in the context of other cases that we've had, that there was abundant evidence, of objective evidence available here for these various escalating searches that were taking place. Plus, this was a court trial, or a jury trial,
This was a jury trial. The jurors found in favor of my client. It was just an advisory.
Well, it's an advisory jury.
So it's not binding, but they did find my client's account to be credible and the government's account not to be credible. I think that
we weigh the trial judge's findings in the federal court.
Well, let's look at the trial judge's findings. She really did not make the findings that was necessary. She said that she would not, quote, second-guess what Martinez said. Now, I don't think there's really any dispute that had Martinez not claimed that a pad was, that she felt something, some bulge or some lump, that the searches would have stopped. I think that, I know that is the testimony that came out. Martinez testified, absent this physical finding during the pat-down, I wouldn't have gone farther.
The judge then makes this curious statement that she's not sure that Martinez is telling the truth, but she's going to defer. What's the basis for that?
That, I think, is the problem. She believed that unrealistic second-guessing language comes from the Montoya D. Hernandez decision, but it's completely in a different context. In that context, they were determining the length of a detention, and the court said, well, we're not going to decide what is a reasonable or unreasonable detention. In this case, she was required to make some sort of credibility determination as to Martinez. That the findings of the pad was the only thing that progressed that search further. Both Woods and Martinez stated that. So that determination, or her failure to make that determination, was critical. And she didn't make that determination, one, because she somehow believed that she should defer to the agents, and there's no case law that supports the deferral on a reasonable suspicion question.
Please continue your thought.
Yeah, she also believed, and she sort of combined the willful and wanton standard in with this.
Now, let me stop you there. What is your position on the use of that willful and wanton standard? Does that Illinois Tort Immunity Act get incorporated into the Federal Tort Claims Act?
I believe it does. Judge Shader, I think in the Warner opinion.
Judge Shader says yes, that he's a district judge, and a district judge in the Eastern District of New York says he's all wet. Why should we believe Judge Shader and not the judge in the Eastern District of New York? And why are you so willing to accept Judge Shader and not the district judge in the Eastern District of
New
York?
We did raise that issue. I do not stand here and agree necessarily that it was incorporated. That is what she found, and I think the New York decision does make a lot of sense. When we chose to go with the federal tort claim, we didn't necessarily realize that all these state immunities would be incorporated. So I guess I don't have a good answer for that. I do think that this court can fairly follow that New York case.
Could I ask you, just to go back to Martinez for a second, suppose Judge Pallmeyer had said, I think Martinez was lying when she said she felt a bulge, but everything else that had gone, that had occurred up to that point, nonetheless made it reasonable just to check the visual body cavity search because of, you know, the source country and all, you know, the various other things that had already happened. I guess what I'm asking is, how important is this Martinez, is the absence of a finding one way or the other on the credibility of Martinez to the outcome?
It is critical. It is the critical factor, even by the government's own admissions. As I said, both Martinez and Woods testified that the search would have gone no further absent this finding. So it is critical. If you look at each of these things, and I'm asking you to look at them carefully, how do they apply to this client, to this passenger? The money issue you raised, Your Honor, she purchased the ticket with cash, but according to Judge Pallmeyer, it's undisputed that it was purchased 13 days ahead of time, it was purchased from a travel agency, and it was purchased through Apple Vacations. So how does her purchasing it with cash make it more likely that she's a drug dealer? That whole cash issue at a ticket counter has to do with concealing one's identity. The same thing with the driver's license. She identified her address, her current address, which was 4800 on Marine Drive. She identified it on her declaration form, on the ticket information, et cetera. She wasn't trying to hide her identity. She just happened to have another driver's license.
When did they learn that the address was somehow connected with some heroin activity?
Well, I don't know when they learned it. We learned it during the course of trial. We deposed Martinez. We deposed White.
Did she know it?
No.
Did Martinez know it?
No, they didn't disclose it. It first came up during trial, and we were sandbagged with that. However, even if we had known it, what probative value could the fact that someone in the neighborhood, Woods talked about criminality in the neighborhood, how can that be a particular and objective factor to indicate that this person is a drug smuggler? It doesn't make sense. She lived in a condominium. She lived in 812, apartment 812. There were 8 floors. It was in Chicago, I think in the uptown area. 2 floors down, some men who, you know, she didn't even know, because this, we know that this happened before she even moved into the building. How can that be probative? The fact that someone in her neighborhood, in her building, might have been a criminal. Are we required to run checks on our neighbors and our friends to make sure we're not associating with the wrong people? She didn't know. And for the court to repeatedly refer to that was completely, completely disingenuous. But, of course, we had no way to attack it. We had no forewarning. This was supposedly something that came up during the government's preparation. I would like to say the text, too, is supposed to be the contemporaneous account, the contemporaneous recording of what happened. Okay, look at the text too, which is attached and is a joint exhibit and was referred to at length at trial. If you look at Martinez's report, there is nothing that refers to the finding of a pad. If you look at it, the pat-down search of Ms. Kniff was also negative. Nowhere on this report, which is contemporaneous, do we see any mention of a pad. To a reasonable person, and I think to Judge Pallmeyer, had she reached this credibility determination, this means that Martinez was making this up. She's making it up after the fact. It's not located in the report. On the PAU, drafted by Guadalupe White, there is no mention of some drug seizure made long before Kniff came across the border. No mention at all. Passenger traveling from Jamaica. It indicated she was there 4 days. Period. That is what we have to rely on. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Powell.
May it please the court, counsel. Kniff had a week-long trial in front of a district court judge who gave a hard and skeptical review to the testimony of the customs inspectors and the reasons for the search.
Let's stop right there. I mean, this hard and skeptical review seems to have lapsed when it came to the question of whether Martinez was lying about what she felt during the pat-down.
I suggest this court
may be. She did her obeisance to the Supreme Court and said, well, I think I've examined the clothing. I don't see how you'd make a mistake on this. I really have a question about this, but the Supreme Court says I got to bow to the customs inspector, so I'm going to bow to the customs inspector. Is that what we pay the district judge the big bucks for?
Your Honor, I think the district court wrote her opinion in a guileless way. If you read it, there's absolutely no question that she believed Martinez was telling the truth in the case.
No, she expresses specific skepticism, and it looks like she's confusing the question she needs to ask in a Federal Tort Claims Act case with the question one might ask, you know, on a motion to suppress or on in other legal contexts where if you thought the officer was within the realm of reason, you might defer to the officer. But this is a tort claim case, and she says, I've looked at the jeans. They're very thin fabric. I mean, she goes on and says, how could this have been true?
The district court was clearly troubled by the fact that the partial strip search didn't turn up anything tangible to explain what it was that Inspector Martinez had felt. And,
of course, you know the part of the opinion Judge Ripple is talking about. It's page 20. Court notes its own skepticism concerning Martinez's testimony that she felt the bulge. She offered the jeans in evidence. The denim fabric was thin and worn. No unusual thickness or gathering of fabric. No testimony that her anatomy was unusual. And the court has no indication of what it was that Martinez could have felt. And then she may make a legal mistake here. She thinks it's her job to defer somehow to Martinez's statement instead of make an evaluation as to whether Martinez is telling the truth or not. Where does that come from in the law?
Your Honor, I think she was required to make an evaluation of Inspector Martinez's testimony, and I think she did that.
And suppose she had said Inspector Martinez was lying when she said she felt a bulge in the plaintiff's crotch area. How does the rest of the opinion continue?
Well, I'd like to, before getting into beyond that point, I'd like to keep at the point on whether Inspector Martinez...
Let's take that point for the moment, because that's the question I asked your opponent, too, and I would like to know how, if she thinks that Martinez is lying, how the rest of this is reasonable.
Well, Your Honor, I would like to address that, but I think it's clear that Judge Pallmeyer didn't think that Inspector Martinez was lying. In fact, if you look right there at the section of the opinion that you're talking about, she goes on and moves it. She says she's not going to discount Inspector Martinez's testimony. I think that means she credits it. And she goes on to consider the willful and wanton part of the equation. And, you know, in this case...
She thinks she's second-guessing Martinez, though. She says, without more evidence to go on, the court would most certainly engage in the proscribed, unrealistic second-guessing were it to discount completely Martinez's account of the strip search. It just sounds like legal confusion to me. I think had to decide, did somebody say this or not? Are they telling the truth or not? Even on suppression hearings, for that matter. If the police are lying, they're lying.
Right. Your Honor, I think if Judge Pallmeyer had believed that Inspector Martinez was not telling the truth, she would not have hesitated for one second to come out and say that affirmatively. Now, she does address the willful and wanton issue, and what she says on that issue is there was no evidence in the case which even arguably would show willful and wanton conduct on the part of the inspectors. And I think it's safe to say that if she believed that Inspector Martinez was lying about what she felt during that pat-down search, that would at least arguably be willful and wanton misconduct. And when she talks about the standard, what she says there is she assumes the worst-case scenario. You know, you were talking about assuming that Inspector Martinez is lying. She assumes the worst-case scenario, and it doesn't have Inspector Martinez lying. What it has is assuming the worst-case scenario for her, that is, that Inspector Martinez imagined it or overestimated what she felt.
With respect to the willful and wanton standard, was the testimony, was there not, of the plaintiff that the officers at one point, by their facial and body expressions, indicated they might have been enjoying their work a little too much?
Yes, it was.
Wasn't there some testimony as well that at least that one male outside the room seemed to be have a pretty good idea of what stage they were at inside the room?
Your Honor, those were all, yes, there was testimony about that effect, and this plaintiff had a trial in front of a district court judge that was no less sympathetic to Ms. Kniff than you or I, and she had her chance at trial. Those are issues for trial, and the district court
resolved. But you told me there was no evidence with respect, that she said there was no evidence with respect to the willful and wanton standard. And my question is, well, isn't that evidence of willful and wantonness?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a you know, as far as what those inspectors were thinking at the time, I think you could argue that way. You know, she had her chance to do that in the district court, and the district court obviously didn't put credence into
if
that.
If I could say this, but turn from facts to law for just a moment, please. This whole willful and wanton standard, of course, presupposes that the Illinois Tort Immunity Act is operative here. Why should it be operative? Why is it not I mean, if Illinois wants to grant that much immunity to its public officers, why should that interfere with Congress's judgment as to what standard federal officers ought to be held to?
Your Honor, the rationale behind that is that in the Federal Tort Claims Act, the government actor is analogized to a like individual in the private sector, and there is no like individual in the private sector who is authorized to perform these sorts of law enforcement searches. So that's the rationale behind it. In this particular case, I believe that counsel is in error when she says that they raised that issue in the district court. My recollection is that was accepted in the district court. Certainly isn't raised on appeal, and so that's not briefed before you today. It's waived for purposes of appeal, and I don't think this is the right case in which to address that.
But it'd be hard for us to write an opinion, though, not address it, wouldn't it? If we reach one result, if it is operative, and one result if it's not.
Well,
I know we've run into this with these waiver situations. You know, you have to decide the case on bad law.
Well, that's right. You know, I think the willful and wanton standard is outcome determinative. You know, ultimately, that's the finding that has to be made if it applies. So I don't think you have to reach the willful and wanton standard in this case at all to affirm the district court. So you can put that out of the calculation. You know, the district court, you know, granted she did not have an express line in her opinion where she says, you know, I find Inspector Martinez is telling the truth when she says that she found that. But, you know, I think you need to consider who the district judge is, the way she wrote her opinion in this case, and it's absolutely clear from the opinion that she credited Inspector Martinez's testimony. Now, she may have had doubts about whether Inspector Martinez was...
Why did she write this sentence, then? If a court is crediting somebody, the court doesn't usually write, the court notes its own skepticism concerning Martinez's testimony that she felt a bulge. I mean, that's not language I expect to hear when the district judge turns around and says, therefore, I believe Martinez. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Well, I think it's appropriate for her to be skeptical. I think that's just what the plaintiff should expect out of a district court judge. I assume that when you listen to me talk here this morning, you're skeptical about what I'm saying.
I don't think you're lying to me.
But that doesn't mean you're lying to me. Well, being skeptical of something doesn't mean that you believe it's a lie. What that means is that you don't take for granted that it's true. So
but you're not a fact witness in front of us today, and Martinez was. Martinez is saying, these are the things I observed that made me proceed further in this search. Now, that's facts. That's not talking about whether there's a willful and wanton standard and whether I happen to agree or not agree or think it's waived or otherwise.
Right.
You know, did you drive your car to work today?
I think it's appropriate for a district court judge to evaluate a witness's testimony with skepticism, not to take for granted that it's true. That's what it means if you're skeptical of a witness's testimony. And then she goes on, and the language that you cited there at the bottom of the page may be inartful. I think what she's talking about there is the fact that under the Supreme Court decisions in Ornelas and Arvizu, once Inspector Martinez does feel something, you're not supposed to second guess.
If we had nailed that fact down, I would certainly agree with you. But the problem is, you would be here screaming if the court had said, it's my obligation not to indulge in unrealistic second-guessing of Ms. Kniff's account of what the customs officials did to her. You'd be saying, why is the court deferring to Ms. Kniff's account? And why do customs inspectors get greater credibility as a matter of law?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any, you know, while the opinion is written that way because she's troubled by the fact nothing was turned up, I don't think there's any way any of us here can imagine that Judge Pallmeyer didn't believe Inspector Martinez. If she had felt Inspector Martinez was lying, she would have said so. And I think also it's clear she didn't believe that she wasn't required to scrutinize Inspector Martinez's testimony. In fact, that came up during closing argument when plaintiff's counsel made an argument to the advisory jury in the case, where he was saying that, you know, that everyone in the courtroom here is bought and paid for by the U.S. government, including the government counsel and the district court judge, and you're the only ones who are not. And at that point, Judge Pallmeyer interrupted him and told him clearly that she was paid by the government, but that she understood that her role was to evaluate the testimony of the witness, and she wasn't taking anything for granted. You know, I think she starts out her opinion saying how she's skeptical of Inspector Martinez because she's giving Inspector Martinez that rigorous review. And, you know, it may be possible to twist that one comment that she makes at the bottom of that page into interpreting that to say that she thought that, you know, she didn't have to judge Inspector Martinez's credibility.
She's confused. I mean, the district judges have a hard job. They have so much on their docket, and the Ornelas standard is maybe not the world's clearest thing. People do make mistakes. It doesn't mean she's a bad judge. It doesn't mean anything. And if she was confused about the standard, that's why we're sitting around earning the big bucks.
Right.
You know, we have more time. We are able to look at these things.
Well, I think it's a fair reading of her opinion that she credited Inspector Martinez's testimony, but I'd like to go ahead.
Okay.
In your experience, district judges are very clear when they are rejecting somebody's testimony as unbelievable. And they know how to say it. They know how to write it. And that's not here, is it?
I think that's exactly right. I was trying to say that earlier. I think you're also dealing with a district court judge. And you may have some district court judges who know how to write an opinion to make sure it's not going to be reviewed or reversed in a case. You know, this isn't a district court judge like that. She just wrote down what she thought and was extremely candid about what her thoughts in the case were. And, you know, I really think that if she had a belief on her part, or even if she were ambiguous about whether Inspector Martinez were telling the truth, she would say so. You know, worst case scenario for her is, and you look at the next page of her opinion, worst case scenario is that maybe she imagined it or overestimated what she felt during the pat down. And she does talk about these factors, like there's no malice on her part, there's no those sorts of things, which go to show also she's making that credibility determination. You know, and I agree a judge can be confused. I just don't think she was confused on this point. You know, maybe the language is a little inartful there. And to go ahead with the next point that you were talking about, which is what would be the consequence. You know, and Judge Pallmeyer never did that. She never said what would be the consequence on this if Inspector Martinez were lying. She never said that. But if you take Martinez's, we know what she felt during the pat-down search out of the equation, let's just put it that way. there still was more than enough evidence here to create reasonable suspicion. And as a matter of fact, you know, the strip search wouldn't have happened if Inspector Martinez hadn't felt anything. I think that was the testimony at the trial. So as a matter of fact, that was the reason. But of course, the search could still be legally permissible even absent that. And that would be a legal question of whether there was reasonable suspicion for the search. You know, before I get into that, I just want to say I don't want to abandon Inspector Martinez on this point at all, so I hesitate to get into this. And the district court never went down this road. I don't think it's because she believed that she was, you know, required to accept Inspector Martinez's testimony even if she thought she was lying. But, you know, you go through the facts in the case. You've got a woman returning from a four-day trip to a source country. There's a narcotics dog alerts to her as she comes off the airplane. She's traveling over the Christmas holidays alone at a time when people usually spend with friends and family. She's not on business. She's not traveling to visit friends or to visit family. Her story as to where she's staying changes when she's asked for evidence. First, she says she's staying at a resort. Then, when she's asked for receipts for the resort, she says, oh, I was camping in someone's backyard. Now, she doesn't have a tent with her. She's a person of extremely limited financial means. She estimates her income at about $10,000. She's staying, by her account, at extreme budget-oriented accommodations. She's got $6 with her. Yet, she buys an airplane ticket in cash, pays in cash two or three times what she would have had to spend. You know, I can go. I see I've run out of time.
We've asked you a lot of questions, right. So I'm going to give you another 2 minutes, if you like, and I'm going to give you 2 minutes for rebuttal as well.
But, you know, when asked how she's getting home, she's planning to contact somebody by pager. She can't remember, or she only gives the person's first name, but she's either unable or unwilling to give the person's address. Now, all these circumstances of travel are just the sorts of things that the customs inspectors are looking for. On top of that, her address on her driver's license is inconsistent with the address which she gives the customs inspectors. On top of that, they find that there was heroin seized at her Chicago building. Sure, it's just her building. It only goes so far. And in fact, all these circumstances are consistent with innocence. It's when you put them all together, it adds up to a picture that's what the customs inspectors are looking for in the case. And you know, I can tell you from customs point of view, this isn't a close call on the reasonable suspicions issue. And you know, as you mentioned, there are other cases where the facts are less than here, and you know, all these different factors are cited in other appellate court opinions that we put in our brief, where the customs reliance on these sorts of factors has been approved. And in fact, the customs inspectors did find that there was reasonable suspicion for going to an x-ray search when there was nothing found during the partial strip search. So that was their view of it, and that went all the way up to the chief inspector for that determination to be made. So, you know, sure, Inspector Martinez's reason for asking to conduct the partial strip search was because she felt something during the pat-down search. But as far as what would have happened or what was justified in happening, that's a different question. So if there are no further questions, we'd ask that the district court decision be affirmed.
Many thanks. You have 2 minutes now, Ms. Powell.
I urge this court to take a careful look at the Brent versus Ashley case and the Adahi case. In both of those cases, the court goes through each circumstance, each element, to really determine whether there is an objective and particularized suspicion. In this case, had they asked Kniff some simple questions, had they done some minimal investigation, they would have found that her brother was killed, that she received money from the settlement, and all of the issues about her low-paying job, she was self-employed, she was a hairdresser, all the issues about the expensive ticket would be gone. It would be explained. But Martinez didn't do that. and Woods didn't do that because they didn't care about this passenger. They didn't care that there were innocent, reasonable explanations. The fact that she went to a source country, Jamaica. Jamaica is also a country where a lot of people go to recreate. And that's what she was doing. In this case, she had gone for, I think, 5 years prior. This court and the customs inspectors should have considered those other factors, not just source country, cash, this, that. How does it relate to this person? What factors did they inquire further into? Here, there was nothing. And for these reasons, we ask that you reverse the district court judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel for the